Okay, hi everyone. Welcome back to Strange New Worlds, a science and Star Trek podcast. I'm Mike Wong.
I'm Kim.
And I'm an astrobiologist and planetary scientist.
And I'm not. I'm a science journalist.
And today we are reflecting on the third episode of Season 5 of Star Trek Discovery, titled Janal. But before we get to Janal, I think as Star Trek fans, both of us, we've just got to respond. Why are you laughing? You're a Star Trek fan.
Speak for yourself. But let it be known that I'm not as crazy as Mike.
Well, in any case, we've got to respond to two pieces of news that came out this past week. The first is good news. Star Trek Strange New Worlds, the TV show, not this podcast, was renewed for a fourth season. So we've had two seasons of Strange New Worlds so far. They are currently producing season 3, and it's already been greenlit for season 4. Kim, how does that make you feel?
Great. If season 3 and season 4 are as good as season 1 and season 2, we're in for a treat.
And now we have to report some sad news. In case you haven't heard, Star Trek Lower Decks, the animated comedy series, is ending after its next season, which will give it a total number of 5 seasons of Lower Decks. Kim, what do you make of that news?
It's really tragic. It's been such a great ride. All the episodes in Lower Decks have been wonderful. It's just like so masterful, so intelligent. It's such a shame that it had to come to an end. I would like to hear from the producers why they decided to end such a successful run. Mike, how do you feel?
Oh, it's a gut punch. I mean, this show has meant so much to me. It's a show really about early career scientists in Starfleet, the grad students and postdocs of Starfleet. And so I really resonated with a lot of the characters, from the wide-eyed, upbeat nature of Tendi, so enthusiastic about her job, to Boimler being so worked up over career advancement, whether or not he will get to continue in Starfleet or effectively get fired for making a bad decision. It's really just such a wonderful show, hilarious, and, you know, it's extra sad when you start to put it into context. You know, 5 seasons of Lower Decks, each with 10 episodes, so that's 50 episodes in total. Back in my day, Kim, we would get 26 episodes of Star Trek each year, and given that Lower Decks episodes are roughly half of the length of a traditional Star Trek episode like TNG, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager, really, we only got the equivalent of 1 season of TNG in all 5 seasons of Lower Decks by time on screen. And that's just painful. Like, canceling Lower Decks after season 5 is like canceling TNG after season 1. How could they do this? I really hope that they reverse this decision. Where do we riot? I want to know. Let's go out and make our voices heard, because whoever is pulling the strings over at Paramount and CBS, I think, is making a big mistake. And out of all the shows currently airing for Star Trek, I thought Lower Decks was the one that could have gone for 10, 20 seasons. But apparently, they're ending it.
You never know. Maybe there's a slim chance they'll come back.
Well, while we pray for Lower Decks, let's return now to Star Trek Discovery, the show that we are currently watching and reflecting on. As always, if you have not seen the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery, the one that is titled Janal, Season 5, Episode 3, don't go any further. Watch that episode and then come back here for this discussion. So, Janal takes us to the planet Trill. Not a strange new world, but a strange old one. The crew of the Discovery go down to Trill because one of the Trill symbionts that survives to this day holds the memories of a person named Janal, who is one of the Federation scientists who actually discovered the progenitor technology. This symbiont is now inside of an old lady, but its consciousness gets transferred to Dr. Culber's body, and Janal-infused Culber then takes Burnham and Book in search of a long-hidden piece of the puzzle. Janal draws Burnham and Book into the nest of a pair of Itranachs, which are these wild, ferocious, house-size wasps that can shoot things out of their faces and cloak. They're terrifying. And he tells them that the piece of the puzzle he hid long ago is basically, you know, over there in the Itranachs' nest. And this, turns out, is a test. The piece wasn't there at all. Janal had hid it somewhere else, but he wanted to see how Burnham and Book would react to this ferocious animal creature.
I see you survived.
Skin of our teeth.
You knew that was their nesting ground, didn't you? And you had us draw our phasers to incite them. Why?
I had to know what you'd do when you encountered a life form vastly different than your own. Would you just see an enemy? Or would you try to connect? That's vital for whoever gets the progenitor's technology. As is the belief in the potential for goodness in all beings. Proceed wisely, Captain. Associate?
Out of curiosity, we hadn't proven worthy. Would you let the Itranachs kill us?
To protect the progenitor's power?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Janal wanted to know if Burnham and Book would simply see the Itranach as a threat, an obstacle to overcome, or if they'd see it as being worthy of connecting with, of respecting. Only the latter kind of person would be worthy of receiving the clue to the progenitor's technology, and Burnham and Book were up to the task. Kim, what do you make of Janal's test?
I thought it was a very interesting test that really centered on empathy. Can humans empathize with an animal that's wild, ferocious, that looks like a threat? I think oftentimes in action movies, especially those in space, when producers or when show writers have the opportunity to really think up the most ferocious, vicious, honestly terrifying, nightmarish predators, animals as threats that humans have to wield guns and vanquish to get to their goal. Animals have just been seen as targets, as challenges to be overcome, to be slain. And I like that Star Trek is now taking a step away from that. These animals are just like beings represented in the Federation. They have rich lives and they just need to defend themselves, just like phaser-wielding Federation members. What struck me was how quickly the Itranachs stopped attacking Burnham and Book. Once they lowered their phasers, clearly these Itranachs can recognize threats and also have maybe some sort of empathy. And in real life, I know some animals have been shown to have empathy, especially those social animals. I'm sure you've interacted with your pets and they've enjoyed cuddles, they've made you laugh, they seem to really want to please you. I don't want to anthropomorphize animals, but research has shown that animals can have rich inner lives, and especially the social animals, they can display some form of empathy. Scientists have shown that some animals display altruism. They're willing to go out of their ways to help another animal, be it of their own species or not, even though they don't get any reward. But if they can perhaps save or help out another being, that's good enough for them, even though they are not rewarded. Research has shown that rats are willing to forego a treat if they can save a drowning companion. There's been observations of wild boars going out of their way to free trapped boars in cages. This isn't the most scientific, but I've seen on social media a clip of a pet dog actually displaying signs of distress by whining and whimpering when he was watching on TV the saddest scene from The Lion King, when Simba's dad, Mufasa, falls off the cliffs and dies. Any human being, me included, would weep at that scene. And I was surprised to watch this clip of this dog displaying the same signs. That dog knew exactly what was going on and could even empathize with a fictional lion on TV. So I don't want to assume or say that this animal feels sad like humans do, but clearly there's some level of connection going on there. So animals are really capable of displaying this kind of empathy that we normally associate with humans. And I think that raises interesting questions that we really shouldn't just sweep animals as vicious beings trying to attack us. There's this movement trying to give legal personhood to animals to protect them from human activity that threatens their existence and pushes them closer to extinction. It's a really interesting concept that's probably a bit too far away from empathy, but I think almost in that vein that humans are sort of finally really seeing these animals as, not say people themselves, but sentient beings really deserving of protection. And if legal means are the way to only do that, to get other people who might not have such empathy to recognize the agency and sovereignty of these animals, maybe the legal means has to be the way to do it. So in New Zealand, indigenous leaders have recognized whales to have legal personhood. That hasn't been adopted in the entire country yet, but we shall see.
Makes you wonder what the Trill's legal standing is toward these Itranachs. I mean, clearly they inhabit the Trill homeworld and are free to fly around and nest where they are, even though they're very dangerous creatures, as was shown in this episode. They could easily kill a human being or a Trill or whatever Book is. Still not really clear what kind of alien he is with his amazing, empathetic, glowing forehead. But what do you think might be the Trill's attitude towards the legal standing of the Itranach?
There's this rule in some states, this stand your ground rule. I'm not sure if I fully agree with it, but it does make a compelling case that if someone invades your home, you have the right to stand your ground and defend. These Itranachs were simply trying to defend their homes. If it were just another human, they would be well within their rights to defend their nest from invaders who had just dropped by out of the blue for no good reasons to potentially pose a threat to the eggs. So I'm not condoning violence here, but if these Itranachs were people, they would definitely unleash the full might of the legal system against the Star Trek Federation. So I like that even though Star Trek is still a long way to like really recognize that animals are sentient beings in this way. But at least it's starting to reflect on itself that animals' rights is an issue. And if you keep going down the road of trying to make for the most action-packed scenes, perhaps at some point you raise these interesting ethical questions.
Excellent. So Burnham and Book end up passing the test by connecting with Itranach, understanding that they are really just trying to protect their eggs, their nest. And this reminded me of the classic Star Trek episode, Devil in the Dark, where the crew of the Enterprise encounters a silicon-based life form, the Horta, which, you know, at the beginning of the episode is painted to be a monster that is just rampaging a colony of miners, but ends up just being a mother trying to protect its young. And here again, we see that kind of connection transcend boundaries. You know, the Itranach are wasp-looking creatures that can cloak and shoot barbs of I don't even know what kind of venom at their prey. Clearly nothing that, you know, you would want to keep around as a cuddly pet or maybe even think of befriending. And yet, Burnham and Book were able to connect on an empathetic level with these creatures.
So, Mike, let's pivot a bit. I now have a question to ask you about the scene where Stamets goes into the new number one's office or quarters, and then he starts talking about half-lives and isotopic decay. Can you explain to us what got him so excited? What was he actually talking about?
Sorry I'm late. I was working on the data from the Romulan tricorder, and I think I finally figured it out.
As long as it's mission critical, use as many words as you'd like.
The thing is, I hadn't accounted for half-life. The Pretenditor's technology is several billion years old, so of course that would result in significant decay of numerous isotopes. I don't fully understand it yet, but the technology is... It could have incredible applications. One could use it to design new life forms, accelerate evolution, modify ecosystems, and if it can create life, then in theory, It might even be possible to reanimate dead organisms.
It sounds like it'd be very dangerous in the wrong hands.
Well, yes, but think of all the good it could do in the right ones. It could make even the spore drive discovery inconsequential by comparison.
Commander,
do you have any more data to share?
No, I guess not.
Then your 20 words are up. You're dismissed.
Nice to meet you too, Commander.
So Stamets is basically going through his interview with First Officer Raynor. These interviews are meant to introduce Raynor to his new crew. He's usually really, really terse with the officers of the Discovery, allowing them only 20 words to teach him something about themselves. Now, Paul Stamets rushes into the interview just bubbly and excited over isotope half-lives and radioactive decay. And he starts babbling about, oh, the Romulan tricorder scans, I finally figured it out. And Raynor basically allows Stamets to exceed the 20-word limit so long as Stamets was helpful toward the mission. Now, Kim, what do you know about isotopes and radioactive decay?
Probably much less than you do, but I know that they've been used as a dating method for really, really old samples, depending on the half-life of the element that's decaying.
That's right. Using the half-lives of different isotopes, we're able to age-date materials from billions of years ago. In fact, this is the technique that we use to figure out the age of the solar system, to pinpoint the origin of the solar system at 4.567 blah, blah, blah billion years old. Actually, a lot of this work was done at our alma mater, Caltech, in the GPS department there, which is a cool little connection. So what happened at Caltech was that people in meteorites looked at the earliest solids of the solar system and looked at the tiny bits of uranium and lead in those inclusions and used isotopic dating to figure out how old those were. And it ends up being something like 4.56 billion years old. So honestly, when Paul Stamets started talking about isotopic half-lives and radioactive decay, that kind of triggered me because this is not at all my favorite topic. It's one of those that I honestly had to teach once a year in our introductory planetary science course at Caltech to a bunch of very smart Caltech undergrads. And every single time I had to teach it, I realized that I had forgotten the material and had to reteach myself right before going into that unit of the course. And I wanted to get it really, really spot on correct because, again, a lot of the pioneering work in dating the oldest materials in the solar system was done at Caltech. So it was a Caltech story, and I wanted to impart that onto the students. But every single year, this material would just fly right out of my brain and I'd have to refresh myself. It's just something that I could never, it was like a boogeyman of planetary science for me, isotopic age dating. Anyway, here's the basic gist of how it works. Different isotopes decay at different rates. So for instance, an isotope of potassium might decay into argon with a half-life of about a billion years or so. Whereas rubidium will decay into strontium with a half-life of 50 billion years, and uranium will decay into lead with a half-life of about 4.5 billion years or 700 million years, depending on the isotope of uranium that you're looking at. Okay, so what does it mean to have a half-life? Well, things decay, and decay is a stochastic process. That's a fancy term for just random. You can never predict when a particular atom will decay into another. But over long periods of time, you can come up with general trends. So just like flipping a coin is more or less random, you can't really predict if it's going to come up heads or tails. If you flip a coin 100 times, you're going to roughly get 50 heads and 50 tails, even though you can't predict any given flip. So same thing with isotopic decay. You never know when the next atom is going to decay, but if you wait a really long time, you'll tend to get a trend where eventually half of the original nuclei in your sample will have decayed from their parent isotope into their daughter isotope. And this takes a really long time. Again, sometimes thousands of years, sometimes millions of years, sometimes billions of years to reach that halfway point. And when you reach that halfway point, that is what we call the half-life of that isotope. So, how do you figure out how much time has elapsed by looking at isotopes? Well, if you know a certain parent-to-daughter isotope system, then the amount of daughter isotope that you have in a sample is going to be the initial amount of that daughter isotope that that sample was born with, plus the amount of the parent isotope that's decayed into the daughter so far. Okay, and so if you can measure the amount of daughter isotope in your sample, then you can easily rearrange that equation and solve for time. That's not the hard part. Here comes the hard part. So the problem is that in order to solve this equation, you need to know the initial abundance of the daughter isotope, which at face value is just like, how would I ever know that, right? I'm just measuring how much there is right now. How do I know how much was at the very beginning, at the birth of this sample's lifetime? So the solution is to do what's called isochron dating, where you essentially divide the entire equation by a stable version of the daughter element. Then, instead of comparing raw abundances of different isotopes, you're now comparing the ratios of different isotopes. And by some magic, by which I mean math, you can eliminate the need to know the initial daughter abundance and solve for time. And when I explain this and teach it to undergrads, I basically take up an entire whiteboard worth of space writing equations and drawing diagrams because it's really helpful to actually plot things out. And it ends up being like the slope of the line defined by the ratio of different isotopes that you measure in your sample that tells you the age of your sample. It's complicated, and I'm not going to explain it to you here. But if you want to learn more, just look up isochron dating, and you'll find the details. But that's basically why I had really bad flashbacks to my teaching days of planetary science when Paul Stamets came in so bubbly into the laboratory and started talking about half-lives and radiometric dating. Okay, so back to Stamets now. Stamets is remarking to First Officer Rayner that he figured it out. The way to make sense of the tricorder readings of the progenitor's technology is to remember that isotopes will decay on the timescale of billions of years. And since the progenitor's technology is billions of years old, a lot of decay will have happened. And so if you just look at the nuclei that make up this technology right now, you will not be seeing the composition of the technology as it was when the progenitors had made it. So this totally makes sense. It was a very clever realization from Stamets. And I think the only thing that could have made it better was Stamets using isochron dating to tell exactly how many billions of years old the progenitor technology is. But again, it was a very clever piece of dialogue, totally scientifically correct that isotopic decay would have happened. And it's my fault that I can never remember how this stuff works and got really panicked by hearing Stamets talk about this subject.
Stamets probably studied his notes before he went to meet with Captain Rayner.
If Stamets is anything like me, he definitely would have had to brush up on this topic too. Anything else from this episode, Janal, that stuck out to you, Kim?
I like the doctor. He looked so different from his usual doctor self.
Yeah, Wilson Cruz just really got to show off his acting there. I mean, so good at being Dr. Culber, and then immediately switching into Janal was so striking, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. I thought the breakup between Adira and Gray was very civil. If only all disagreements could be handled like that, we would have world peace.
Yeah, indeed. And again, this idea of half-lives was brought up initially by Commander Jet Reno to Paul Stamets when referencing the impending dissolution of Adira and Gray's relationship. And that's sort of the seed that Paul Stamets had to analyze his data. Of course, who knows if Paul is being a good parent figure to Adira in this moment. Knowing his personality, maybe not. But at least Jet Reno got him to think about his data differently. So, yay? Well, that's it for Strange New Worlds today. Thank you for listening, as always.
If you like this episode, subscribe to This Strange New Worlds and the other Strange New Worlds. Let's keep both Strange New Worlds going.
Indeed. Couldn't have ended it any better. Hey, our friend Jess said some really nice things about our dual podcasts.
Compliments are always welcome.